Today at Radio Verulam, we are once again speaking to local MP Bim Afolamy to get the answers to your questions. And remember, if you've been not lucky enough to get your question to Bim this time, he will be back again next month. But also, on top of that, there were so many questions this month, and a huge thank you for your input and support to this show, because we want this to be your show. It's the community-led discussions about what is important to you. But obviously, because of so many questions this month and certain issues that we had to talk about, some of your questions will be saved, will be banked, and will be used in the future. However, let's move it to this month, October, and it's been party conference month. The electorate always looks forward to this, Bim, and to find out what each party is offering.
Do they really?
Well, I mean, I'm going to ask this to you. What do you think are the key points from your party conference that will appeal to the electorate, that they can look forward to?
Oh, gosh, now you've got me on the spot. What do I think are the important things from our conference? Now, look, our conference is obviously terribly, terribly important. It was very difficult because this year we couldn't have a physical conference. It was all virtual. And to be frank, you know, the virtual conference, as many people listening will have tried to attend virtual conferences, and, you know, it's not great. And, you know, I don't take anything away from the people who tried to organize it. They did their best, but it's not the same. Having said that, the big thing really that came out of it, in my judgment, was the Prime Minister's, you know, putting the government's weight behind wind power. And now we've frankly done quite a lot of this already. We're the leading wind power generator in Europe. We generate more of our energy from wind, from renewable sources, sorry, than any other G7 country. However, there's always more the government can do. And the Prime Minister made a very big, big push on that. And that is significant. So for anybody who is thinking, what are they doing on the environment? Know that we're really, really in favor of pro-wind power. And the reason for it is not actually per se because of the environment, though of course we all know that's important. It's because it is so significant in terms of high quality jobs as well. It is about high quality jobs all over the country in an industry that will be around for a long time. It's a clean industry that creates high quality, high paying jobs, and it helps the environment as well. There's literally nothing not to like about this. So we should do as much of it as possible. And the Prime Minister committed, I think, to something like £160 million extra to help push behind these projects, though I may have got that figure wrong. It's my memory of about a month ago.
What do you think, though, in terms of the actual party conference? You said there that there was something missing, but what do you think was missing by not having it in person, by going up to Birmingham, you know, the NEC Centre that a lot of Conservatives look forward to, but also lay people to kind of just see what parties are on offer? Is it the fact that you can't answer questions in person to people that maybe are interested in knowing more about these things?
Definitely that's the case, because, you know, what I know as a politician is the function of two things, what I've read, or rather three things, what I've read, what I've experienced, and what people tell me. And when you become a member of parliament, you don't read as much as you used to, because you don't have as much time, though I do try my best. Your experience becomes much more politically focused, which limits you. But people tell you way more stuff. And the ability to interact with people from all range of different industries and charities and third sector and government, I mean, the full thing, you learn a huge amount, you get to meet people, you hear about what's going on in the real world. So that, I think, is really important. But look, I'm not saying anything different to anybody listening whose business is enhanced by being around other people, right? Whether you be in creative industries, whether you be a lawyer, whether you be in a digital company, whether you be trying to be in advertising, whatever it is, I think in most industries, I'm willing to wager, in most industries, you benefit from being around people. And politics is just like that, very much so. So it's a shame we can't do that. But look, we all know the reasons why, and let's not linger on those, and let's hope that it all gets better soon.
Let's also put the shift to, obviously, that's the Conservative Party conference. It's appealing to the whole of the nation. And you've talked there about concerned effort towards greener technology. But what specific ideas and plans do you think from the party conference itself, but also maybe some of your own ideas that will positively affect your constituents in Harpenden and Hitchin?
I mean, the big thing that I'm doing at the moment, and I spoke about it at the conference a few times with people like the City of London Corporation, who, you know, are in charge of the City of London. The London Mayor Sadiq Khan does not have jurisdiction over the City of London Corporation, which is a bit of a quirk, is really financial services, which is of key interest to my constituents. I have literally thousands of people in my constituency, particularly in the southern half, particularly in who's listening in Harpenden and around Harpenden, who work in financial services. And I spent a long time talking about these issues and working on them. There's a new financial services bill coming up in about 2 weeks, 10 days, that I've been engaged with some of the drafting of, because I'm chair of APPG in financial services and markets. I used to work in it and I know a lot of the key people. So I can't reveal what's in it beyond to say that I hope it will be a real benefit to the financial services industry, allow it to grow and develop, in particular now as we try and expand our markets to all over the world. That is one thing that I spent a lot of time at the conference, and that's one thing that I'll be working on in the months and years to come.
And also, the message from Prime Minister Boris Johnson is that the Conservatives will build back better. Now, obviously, COVID is in mind there, but probably the economy as a whole, something that you've mentioned many times, the Prime Minister has mentioned many times, is levelling up. So on top of this world leader in clean energy, what other things can constituents and maybe the whole of the UK look forward to that is being built back better?
The way I'd like to think about it are two main things. Well, three really. One is physical infrastructure in the traditional sense, roads, bridges, all that sort of stuff. And, you know, I'm hopeful about that in this area, not really in this constituency, but more in Hertfordshire. A414 being improved is one thing that I'm campaigning for example. The second thing is what I like to describe as social infrastructure. So things, and the big part of this that I have to admit to being a bit obsessed with is libraries, because I know the importance of libraries to kids whose home doesn't have loads of books. And even if you do have books, being able to work and be somewhere, a shared space that's safe for adults and children and everything in between to be together, there actually aren't many of those. And they perform a really vital function to glue a community together. And if you're setting up a business, the extension of support so that you don't have to go to the British Library in North London, you can actually get advice and support on how to set up your business in your local town or even in your village, I think is of real significance. And I think we're gonna see a lot of that. And then the third thing, and this is a tricky thing to really describe or to elucidate, is really atmosphere, how you feel. I think that levelling up has now gone beyond a political slogan, and it's something that I think people own for themselves. They don't have to be conservative to believe in the need to level up the country. I think that's a very powerful thing. I think that that is where you get real change, because real change can't be dependent on a particular leader or party or government. Real change is something that's in the minds and hearts of the people. And when I think British people, and in this constituency like anywhere else, believe in the essential fairness and the need to try and expand and increase opportunities to as many people as possible throughout the country, not just in places like Harpenden or St Albans that are near enough London where they have access to London and benefit from that, but in places that are much more distant from a big sort of thriving city, and how we achieve that, but also within our own midst, making sure that, you know, the people who don't have the advantages that the majority of people may have, making sure that they have a fair shake at things. I think that's critical importance.
Moving on to some criticism that was actually expressed on Radio Verulam this month, I was talking to Deputy Leader of the Lib Dems, Daisy Cooper, and she stated that she felt that the Conservative Party have lost their humanity, especially when it comes to the treatment of refugees in this country. What is your response to this, and can you explain why the party has seemingly taken a negative line towards people who do have a right to enter the UK to seek safety?
What I would say, I don't want to criticize Daisy personally. It's not personal. She's always been perfectly pleasant to me. But I don't believe this is right. And I think this is really her being political. We have always been a party that supports and helps people who come to this country legally. And I myself am the child of people who came to this country legally. The Chancellor, the Home Secretary, various other people in the Conservative Party are children of people who come to this country legally. And so, I think that we've always been a party that stood up for that. I think the key part of this, of course, is the legally bit. What we have is we, because of our geography, on the, in the northwestern part of Europe, there's been a significant flow of people seeking refugee status in the United Kingdom. But part of some of these people have come through mainland Europe before they seek to claim refugee status. Now, people have a right to want to go to a particular country. I mean, you don't have to go anywhere. But I do think that we've got to be honest about it and be honest and say that if you're coming through Italy, Spain, France, Belgium, Holland, these are perfectly safe countries with which to make asylum, to claim asylum, rather. And so when people don't do that and they seek to go through those countries, of course, by the way, I'm not talking about all of them, I'm talking about a percentage, a number. And they seek to go through those countries and then come for Britain. On one level, I'm heartened because they know what a great country it is, Britain is. But on another level, it makes me think that the reason why they are coming is not necessarily because they are not safe, because they could have been safe at various points along this journey. It's because they want to come to Britain for economic reasons. And again, I don't begrudge them of that at all. It's a great country to be in. And indeed, my parents, my father's a doctor, my mum's a pharmacist, came to this country to seek a better life. I don't object to that at all. But they have to be honest about that. And they have to be honest about that they're coming for the purpose of wanting to come to Britain for economic reasons. And I think that what we need to do is have an immigration system that, yes, is fair, but also is fair to those who seek asylum, but is also fair to those who wait in line in their own countries for years because they are playing by the rules and they don't seek to circumvent them. So fairness does need to go both ways, and also fair to the British people who pay significant amount of taxes. We should probably try and reduce those, though we can talk about that later. They pay a significant amount of taxes. It's their tax money that goes to this system. So we've got to make sure it's done as efficiently and as fairly to them as possible.
As a former lawyer, though, how do you feel about the recent discussion amongst lawyer groups that inflammatory rhetoric has been used by the government and some of its ministers to criticise the legal system? You've explained there your belief that it should be a legal kind of protective process, and obviously part of the asylum seeking process is appealing. But Priti Patel has said some things that people have described as dangerous rhetoric that puts us, being lawyers, at risk of harm. She has been backed up by the Prime Minister as well. So the criticism is aimed at people working within the legal framework. So is it fair, is it right, Bim, to lambast, and this is the quote, lefty human rights lawyers?
I think that political rhetoric can often get a bit noisy. And you know me, and people who know this, who listen to this, know me, and they know that my language is typically very moderate. So it's not necessarily language that I would necessarily use. However, the context is really important. The context is where we have people who've broken the law. We are seeking to deport them in accordance with the law. There is no dispute they've broken the law. Seeking to deport them to their home country. And then there are many law firms that see it as their role. And look, it's a free society. They see it as their role to try and keep those people in the country and will use whatever legal tactic they can. Now, I don't think that is a system that really makes any sense. And I think that we have to try and deal with that, because if you have a legal system that decides that somebody needs to be deported to their country, yet lawyers constantly try and find ways of delaying that process. They can't stop it happening, but delaying that process. The costs for the government and therefore for the taxpayer go up exponentially. So for me, I think that we do need to look at the system. Now, I wouldn't criticize the lawyers. I would say, I want to get and sort out that system so that they can't do those things, because it wastes a lot of time and a lot of money for everybody.
So also this month, October, has been Black History Month, Bim, and you wrote an article in the Daily Mail on Sunday. You explain your feelings on leftist racism in the form of overprotection, and you say that the sad truth is that black people will not be able to fully thrive until conceited liberals of this sort stop trying to keep us in our place. Do you feel the problem emerges from people thinking that they are trying to help, and instead are racist in their own way by controlling discussions in an imposing manner?
Yeah, I do. I do think that. You know, I wouldn't describe it as overprotection. I wouldn't describe it as that. I would describe it as, and look, anybody who's interested should go and read my article in the Mail on Sunday, and it was the third most shared thing on the Mail Online's website on that day. So it got a huge amount of pickup, and I received probably over 100 now emails from people, and probably letters, though I haven't been to my office in Westminster, from people all over the country, including in the constituency, talking about their support for what I was saying. My point is that there is a strand, and I was picking up on Liberal Democrat supporters in Harpenden in particular, a group of them, not all of them, a particular group of them, who were, and I quote in the article, I take direct quotes from Facebook posts, you know, this is all, it's all out there, talking about me being a traitor to my race for being conservative and describing me as a black boy and various other things. And the truth is, what this demonstrates is that for a lot of people who regard themselves to be liberal or liberal left, they do not really want black people to have freedom of choice. If a white person's a conservative, they may not like it, but they don't condemn them as a human being in the same way. If a black person's a conservative, you're a traitor to your race. That doesn't strike me as equality. And the reason why my article struck a chord with so many people is precisely because a lot of people have felt the same way, but yet because of the nature of racial politics, didn't feel the ability to say it. And because I'm an MP and I've got, you know, a big mouth, I felt that I would say it. And I think that the reaction since I wrote the article from some of those very people who have, in fact, the moderator of the admin of the group, as sort of swarming around, sort of saying, well, you know, the person who said this wasn't a member of the Liberal Democrats, though they were a supporter, but they weren't a member. And I said, well, okay, I didn't say they were a member, I said they were a supporter. And you know, it's a distraction from free school meals or whatever. And it just shows the complete blind spot a lot of these people have, because they believe that they are holier than thou, and that if you're black, you should agree with them, you should be on the left. If you're black by nature, you should be oppressed. You shouldn't be able to go to a good university. I went to Oxford University. There are other very good universities. I'm not saying it's the only one. And the criticism I got for going to Oxford University, somehow black people shouldn't be allowed to go to top universities, I think is deeply, deeply depressing. And it's this sort of attitude that holds a lot of black people back, because they're not allowed to make their own way. They're not allowed to decide what they want to do. And as a black person, I regard, with a platform in the public, I regard it as very important to make it clear to people that being a black person does not mean that you have to take any particular ideology or view, and you should be able to be free just as any white person is.
And in this article, you actually discuss, as a young black MP, I'm fully aware that I'm under quite a spotlight, and I don't shrink from that. I use it as to inspire young men and women from all backgrounds, particularly from ethnic minorities. And you explained there that you used your voice to kind of talk about this situation. But I'd like to kind of reflect maybe on what were your experience of racism growing up, maybe within politics as well, that have shaped you, and who were your inspirations growing up, seeing that, you know, you see yourself as maybe a voice for other young Black or BAME community members?
Well, in terms of politics, I won't repeat what I just said in terms of my experience in politics. What I'd say about growing up is, I think the thing I was very blessed, because I grew up in a home where my parents did not have any limits for what they felt that I could achieve. They didn't say you could only do this, you could only do that. And I think that the most important thing that you can do is to make sure people have a sense that they can, that there is no, there are no no-go areas, right? And I definitely had that. What I do remember, my father often mentions this story, is we were going somewhere when I was a kid, and we got on the bus. I must have been it was before I can remember it, so I must have been 2 or 3 or something. And I think the bus driver, it was one of those instances where the bus driver was sort of having a break, or what wasn't in his sort of in his compartment. And we came on, and there was a lady there who said, oh gosh, you know, and was sort of saying, oh, how old is he, to my dad, and saying, oh, he's 2 or whatever. And she said, oh, are you going to be a bus driver just like your daddy? Not having a clue where the bus driver was. Now, this person, by the way, was, I'm sure, a perfectly nice person who meant no ill will at all. However, it's that, the idea that somehow, if you're Black, you can't reach for the stars, you can't reach for something better, that is quite pervasive, and was more pervasive when I was growing up. I'm 34 years old. It's much less pervasive now, but as I described to you before, you know, in this very area, there are significant numbers of people who seem to believe that, you know, if you're Black, you have to be in a certain position or think a particular way or vote a particular way. And that, I'm afraid, I think, is one of the most damaging racist things in our society, because that is what ultimately stops you being successful. Because if you don't expect to be in a room, why should anybody else expect you to be there? And it's something that held back a lot of women for a very long time. I'm not saying it's an analogous experience, because it's not. But you speak to women who are, say, now in their 60s or 70s, when they were coming up through the workplace, they will tell you that. So, you know, I think it's something that as a society we need to tackle. But I have to be honest, it's hard to tackle it, because we are, you're dealing with something that isn't overt. It's not like you're trying to stop people saying the N-word at school or anything like that. It's more pervasive. And a lot of the people who think, you know, the people that proclaim themselves to be the most anti-racist tend to often have some of the most racist views of. And so it's very, very difficult to address the problem.
Linked to this, though, and maybe I've read into this wrong, but there was one point in the article where you explained that you spearheaded a scheme to show young Black people that they did not take it for granted that they would be accepted anywhere if they had the talent, that they felt that certain places, certain jobs and certain positions were not for people like them. However, data shows that certain jobs and positions were not available to BAME individuals for no other reason than race. So what was the meaning behind your sentence here?
What I was trying to say was really reflect the conversation I'd had. And this is really about a system, a program I have called Opportunity Fellows, which I take 14 kids from my constituency. I've got 6 secondary schools. Well, now I've got 7, but 6 full secondary schools plus 2 extras. They were identified by their schools, not by me, as people of high potential who may have come from sort of underprivileged background. I gave a bunch of criteria and the schools picked them. And I think that was very important. And I put on a scheme whereby we did 2 days of at the law firm Norton Rose, who were incredibly helpful. And it's worth giving them a shout out for just their complete commitment to the program and their commitment to all things social mobility. So I really respect what they did. So they gave us 2 days of, it was really soft skills. It's public speaking, interview prep, how to hold yourself, right the way down to sort of how to conduct a business meeting. And these were things, and these kids were sort of anything from 16 to 17, 18, that was the sort of age. And we did that, then we did a week work experience in Parliament where I placed everybody with different colleagues of mine, and then a week in industry where they worked in different things. So one person was at KPMG, another was at a tech startup, another was at a PR firm, you know, different sorts of things, but they were all meant to be white collar professional firms. And why I said the sentence was, the reason why I focused on the soft skills at the beginning, and I did this with the help of a charity, by the way, called the Patchwork Foundation, which are also a fantastic charity who helped me put together the program. I wouldn't have been able to do it without them. But the reason why I focus on the soft skills at the beginning is you can't just, even if someone's really clever, you can't just send them into an environment that's so unused to their home life and expect them to thrive. Someone's got to be prepared for that. And so what we, the first 2 days were, well, partly it's the kids to get to know each other, but it's also just to build their confidence. They all had to wear a suit. They had to build their confidence in smart office environment. And that is so key to you doing well in the workplace, because you've got to feel that you can behave, you can act. When you walk into a room, people don't look down and shuffle. They know you're meant to be there. And so it sounds quite ephemeral, but it's actually very, very important. Building on that, then you can actually be successful. And that's the sort of thing that your sort of typical middle-class kid from, say, St. Albans just doesn't have to worry about, because they've been training that their whole life, though they don't realize they have. And by the way, so they should be, and their parents are bringing them up correctly. It's not a negative at all. But I just think that what I was trying to do with these kids is to bring them up to that level. And in fact, I did a catch-up call with them all a couple of days ago just to check how they're all doing, because this year I couldn't bring the new cohort forward because of COVID. I just didn't think it was going to work this year. But next year, I'm going to expand the program significantly.
So basically, what you meant by that sentence then was that they shouldn't feel like that, and that you were giving them the confidence and the skills to never be in that position to feel like they were exactly lesser than others are.
Yeah.
So that is nicely explained. And, you know, we're going to move it into the community questions here now, because a lot of people have sent questions in. As always, we want these discussions also to focus on what the community want to talk to you about BIM. They have their questions, yeah, and you can help them out. So let's move it in. And the first question that I have been sent has been sent in by literally hundreds of people, and the messages focus in and around the government voting down the proposal for free school meals until Easter next year. So starting the discussions on this topic, because I think there's a few things to just, you know, iron out and talk about. As there's a lot of things related to this, why did you and the government feel justified in taking this position?
Because free school meals in the holidays is a poorly directed policy that doesn't actually help a majority of children. And this is well known within the third sector. It's well known within the charitable community. It's well known amongst academics. And the reason for it is this. When you give, and effectively what this means is you would be effectively giving food vouchers to kids, or rather to parents of kids, for the holidays. Now, why we have a welfare system is that a welfare system is meant to support people when they can't support themselves, right? Whether that be through disability, whether it be through lack of work, et cetera. And I think everybody understands that. During term time, because kids are at school every day, it makes sense. We've done it for over 100 years. It makes sense, whilst the kids are at school, to make sure they eat and to make sure that you 100% know they've eaten. Because when a kid is at school, for that period of time, they're not actually the responsibility of the parent. I mean, they are the responsibility of the parent, but the parent doesn't have an ability to do that. The parent can sometimes afford to help them do that, sometimes they can't. But when they are at school, we've taken the decision for over 100 years to support them to do it. But we don't do it at weekends, for example. So for a long period of time, as in up until the present day, We've used the welfare system in the holidays to support people. To deal with the pandemic, we increased the amount for universal credit by £20 per head for an adult on universal credit. And we've done that because we wanted to just increase the amount of money people had, because we knew things were particularly tough. And I think that's the right decision. I think that should stay. We also gave extra money to local councils, wherein local councils set up particular sort of, in different councils in different areas, different things. Some councils set up hardship funds. Some councils gave it to charities to help get food to kids or families. You know, councils do different things. But we also gave them extra money to make sure that in the holidays, we didn't end up with a difficult situation. What free school meal vouchers do, if you do that, is fine. Yes, you give vouchers. So there'll be kids whose parents won't have to now pay for it, right? They get the extra help, but they're not paying for it. You give them vouchers. But actually, for that amount of money, the evidence has shown this summer, in particular this year, the evidence showed that most of the vouchers weren't taken up. So it didn't seem to be very well directed, because actually a lot of those kids didn't need them and their parents wanted to feed them themselves. They didn't want to rely on vouchers. And I think there's something stigmatizing about vouchers, going into a shop using vouchers. I think it's less stigmatizing, in my personal view, and I accept this may just be, you know, I'm not saying anybody has to agree, to give someone extra money, to give a family extra money so that they can choose how best to do that, rather than necessarily give vouchers. But, you know, I think that there's an argument either way. And so really, it's a debate around how we help these vulnerable kids, rather than a debate of whether to help vulnerable kids or not. And that's really how I see it.
Can I ask, though, because this was the same setup, you know, what you've explained there, the parameters of extra money per week, per head, £20 extra per head in terms of universal credit, and also the money going to extra going to councils. This was the same setup that in June, the government actually made the U-turn to kind of back up the campaign that was run by Marcus Rashford, but run across the country. So what was different in June that's different now?
Very, very good question. You might think that. The truth is that, as you can see, these things in the press, PR, famous footballer, they just sometimes build up ahead of steam. And I think that the government just chose to take a different decision this time than they did before. I happen to think, as I say, it's not a sustainable policy to every holidays have an argument about, you know, whether we use free school meal vouchers or not. The way we should be doing this as a country is working out, identifying all the kids that don't have enough food to eat or at danger of not having enough food to eat. And we've got a reasonable sense of who they are, but in some areas we know more about them than others. Identifying them, and in local areas, working with individuals, families, and communities to make sure they get the food they need. I don't necessarily think a one-size-fits-all works. As I say, over the summer when we did free school meals and food vouchers, it was mostly not taken up by the families. So something's not going right. Either the families didn't need it, or something else was happening. But if most of it wasn't taken up, that was frankly a very well-directed policy. We've got to try and direct it to those who most need it. But I don't blame anybody for thinking how they do on this subject. I think that if you read the newspapers, you'd think that we were taking away free school meals or something. You know, so, you know, in politics, you get these storms. And the important thing is you make policy for the long term in a sustainable way. We've obviously got Christmas coming up. We've got, you know, which will still be in the middle of a pandemic. So, you know, I think it's fair to say I don't want to be having this discussion with you in about 2 months' time.
And in terms of it then, because you've pointed out that obviously the food vouchers didn't work in a sense over the summer. Is there going to be a consultancy period now to maybe try and find a better alternative or a better way to streamline the system? Because you've explained that there are problems there. How are you going to find the solutions?
Very good point that There are problems, and as I say, I don't shy away from those. I'm afraid I just don't know how we're going to find the solutions. The truth is, to some degree, this is a very intractable problem. You know, the Labour government, which were in office during the financial crisis, you know, up until now, the biggest recession of our lifetimes, they didn't extend free school meals in the holidays. And the reason was because they thought it was a poorly directed policy. And yet you still had some families who, you know, slipped through the net. So look, this is a very, very difficult problem. I'm hoping that in this county, in this my constituency in particular, where we've got actually comparatively small numbers of kids on free school meals, it will be easier for us to identify those kids than it is in certain other places. But I'm not saying that definitely. I hope that's the case.
So let's move on then to some other community questions here, because it's been a very busy month for you and a busy month for constituents as well. And Charlotte has messaged in linked to schools, but this is about exams. And she said since September, schools have been operating with full classes again, dealing with changing guidance and also juggling many absences due to issues with COVID testing and self-isolation rules. She's asked, in the light of these additional pressures on school, where do you stand on SATs and statutory testing such as year one phonics tests being cancelled this year? Do you think it's actually feasible for schools to have run tests in the midst of the pandemic?
Oh gosh, this is a difficult question, and this lady clearly knows what she's talking about. So I'm gonna tread very carefully. What I would say is this: it is really difficult for schools, as we know, with exams. Sorry, with the sort of A level GCSE exams. I think they've been pushed back 3 weeks or so to give some extra time. So I think that recognition is there that it's not a normal year. So if you accept it's not a normal year, then that shouldn't just be the case for A levels and GCSEs. That should flow all the way down to SAT. And I think that's a perfectly logical place for the constituent to be. I'm not sure whether we should just say we're not going to do any testing at all. I think that we do need to make sure we monitor progress. That is important. And teachers don't like it because quite understandably, because they want to focus on actually teaching kids, and they don't want to focus on doing tests, and they don't want to teach the test. They want to teach them in a more fundamental, substantive way. And look, I agree with that, and I understand that. But I do think it is important as a government, if you're educating kids in state schools, you need to know where they are. You need to have a sense of progress, and you need to hold schools and teachers and head teachers to account for when kids are failing in a particular area. So I don't know whether we should not have them. I'm willing to say that maybe there's some sort of version of the test that we could do, maybe working with the teachers that is less onerous in terms of logistics and admin for them, and also just for making sure that the kids all can give it their fair, you know, give it a good whack. Maybe it's pushing back the test a bit of time as well, a bit like A-level and GCSEs. But I do think we should measure in some way how kids are doing. I do think we do have to do something, both in phonics and in relation to the other.
Now, Ryan has mentioned a different topic here, and it's the CHIS bill. It's one that was recently passed through the Commons, and he's explained his belief that it would allow state spies to commit crimes in the UK and overseas with impunity, without even exempting crimes like murder, torture, and sexual offences. This is being rushed through Parliament, he says, at breakneck speed with insufficient scrutiny. So Ryan asks, how is this attack on freedom and human rights being allowed to pass?
Look, I think this is a really, really interesting point because it's got lost in all the sort of COVID stuff. But it's really, really important what we allow British spies to do abroad. And I think he's right, Ryan is right to think about it. The way how it has been explained to me, and I'm sort of, you know, I never knew before COVID, I never knew how much of a libertarian I was. You know, I'm very much somebody that I'm very freedom loving, and I think it's of critical importance for our whole society. So I was initially quite skeptical about this. I thought, well, they've been managing it all this time. You know, what's wrong with continuing as we are? And the way it was explained to me was that it wasn't that we were giving them impunity. That is not true. What will happen is there is still oversight of every single person operating on behalf of Her Majesty's government abroad. The point, however, is the process for managing that and overseeing it is more streamlined. And there will be significant parliamentary oversight with the Intelligence and Security Committee, which has some of the most senior MPs from all parties. There will also be a need for the agencies to justify much more and in much greater sense to Parliament what they're up to. And this is really difficult because the truth is, as an MP, you've got, unless you're on the Intelligence and Security Committee or your Home Secretary, Foreign Secretary, or Prime Minister, you don't really have the foggiest what these guys are up to. So it also contains provisions to increase the amount of communication and the clarity with which they communicate to MPs. So overall, I think it is a fair piece of legislation. It's really important that our spies can operate effectively. It's also my understanding, though I have to be honest, I haven't checked this independently, but it's my understanding that it will bring our spies much more in line with spies from the developed world. So this is as much a tidying up process as anything else, making sure that we're operating under broadly the same rules as lots of other people. But I have to be honest, I haven't checked all those other ones. So that's just what I was told. But I think overall it's sensible. But I do completely understand his concerns, completely understand.
Now, Lucinda has asked a question that I think is a bit of a personal one about your conduct in Parliament. She's asked, do you ever vote against a party and instead stick to personal principles? And she's also asked a follow-up question of, can you give an example where have you gone against the party whip?
Yes, though it depends what it is, because I think that you're a party. We have a parliamentary system. When you vote for a Conservative MP, you're voting for a Conservative government and a Conservative Prime Minister. And it's important that the Conservative Party stays united to deliver the programme it's elected on. There are no prizes for departing from that. However, there are obviously instances as an MP where you feel you don't want to support something. The best example I would give is that during one of the interminable Brexit crises that we had, and I forget exactly when it was, but I voted, you know, I did not vote for sort of in favour of no deal, though that was the government's line. And I deliberately voted against that. And that caused me significant difficulty at the time. Not that it didn't, you know, it doesn't necessarily do you credit with people who, you know, don't necessarily appreciate that. But I just thought that, bearing in mind the fact that I had agreed and been very clear that I didn't think leaving without a withdrawal agreement was a sensible thing, I couldn't vote for that in the affirmative, which I did not. So that is probably the best example I can give.
We'll link to that. And one last question before we get into the final summarising one. A different Charlotte, a different one to the one that asked you a question earlier.
Are you sure Charlotte isn't sitting there sending you lots of different emails?
Well, you know, we've got Lucinda and Ryan as well. But Charlotte, okay, I did check it was a different email. And she's asked,
okay, that's fine.
How is a no-deal Brexit best for us, his constituents? So she obviously is one
of... It's not best. I mean, nobody thinks that, right? Like, nobody with a brain thinks that. But the question is whether you can avoid it or not. I'm pretty confident. In fact, this afternoon, I was on the phone to a friend who is very close to the negotiating team on the EU deal. And I am more confident than I've been at any point this year that we will get an agreement. So, you know, I'm hoping that this will, you know, all not be of any relevance at all.
Okay, so there may be a deal then in the works, because at the moment the kind of discussions are on a no deal. So that might be a boost. I mean, there.
We saw this with Theresa May and her negotiations. We saw it then. You just can't take at face value what is said after these EU meetings. It's just for theatre. It isn't true about what's actually going on. And really what I'd ask people to do if they're worried about it is to wait and see what happens. What I would say to them is, the fact that there isn't much being talked about is a very good sign. are serious negotiations happening and that we are hopefully almost there in the next few weeks.
That might be reassuring then to Charlotte and other people that do have genuine concerns about a no-deal Brexit. But I'm going to finish on a positive one. I always try to finish on something, you know, that put a smile on people's faces. And Anita has asked, you are a fellow parent during this scary time of spooky season. Have you anything special or fun planned for you and the family during Halloween? And on top of this, do you have any plans for the 5th of November Guy Fawkes Night?
Wow. Now, this is probably very bad, but I haven't really given it any thought. What I would say is that my boys are now, my two older boys, I've got three, are probably big enough now that they can they could go trick-or-treating. However, they're not allowed to do that, I'm told. I was told by the chief whip that under no circumstances should we have our kids out trick-or-treating. We'd all get into trouble. So they're not going to go trick-or-treating. But what we'll probably do is do cut out some pumpkins and light tea lights in them and something like that. And on bonfire night, what we will do is we will have a bonfire in our garden where I've got one building and various things that various sort of tree stumps and logs and various things I wanted to burn. So I am, because we live in the outside of village, so in the country, so I am keen to actually do a proper bonfire on bonfire night, you know, at home. Apart from anything else, I can't go to any other bonfires. I may as well have my own.
And I always think, is there like a bit of funniness in Parliament as well, talking about the 5th of November, you know, celebrating a plot to potentially blow up the parliamentary building? Is the kind of funniness and irony lost on you?
No, it's not. I remember one year, was it last year? I think it was the year before last. Having a joke with Jacob Rees-Mogg about this, because Jacob is a very strong Catholic, you know, the number of kids sort of tells you. And we were making all sorts of jokes about the 5th of November. But also, the thing people don't realize about Jacob is that he's incredibly knowledgeable about Parliament and about its history. If I've got any question, I will always ask him. And he was telling me various different stories of individuals involved with the gunpowder plot who did deals with so-and-so or so-and-so and managed to survive or shocked out Guy Fawkes and his mates. And so there is a lot of history there. And as somebody who is a very, very keen historian, I find the whole thing absolutely fascinating. And one thing people don't realize about Parliament is every single morning before prayers, which is where just before the day starts, and there are prayers in the chamber where no guests are admitted. Sniffer dogs go around the whole of Parliament and the chamber every single day, every single day. And that is all came out of the gunpowder plot and all of that, which I always think is a little quirk.
Fascinating insight into Parliament there. And as always, thank you for your time today, Bim. And for
No
those of
problem.
you,
Thank you.
and for those of you who didn't get your question answered this month, Bim will be returning in November.